This segment is brought to you by Jigmasters. Step up your game with high-quality performance jigs, spinnerbaits, buzzbaits, and more from Jigmasters.com. And always, when in doubt, get the jig out.
Welcome to the Feather and Fur segment on the Paddle and Fin Podcast Network. Join me, Brad Hurlibus, as we sit around the campfire with this week's special guest to talk hunting, dogs, traditions, and all things outdoors. Welcome back, everyone. Another episode of the Feather and Fur Podcast. Of course, Brad Hurlibus, your host for tonight. Tonight, we have Upland Arizona on, which is going to be a great trio of guys from Arizona, obviously, hunting the birds. But before that, last week, we had Steve Schaefer, my good buddy, grouse hunting friend on. Phone was dying. We didn't give him a chance to do any shout-outs. So I want to give you his Instagram page, so that way there, if you listened to the show last week, you can look him up. If you didn't, you can go back, listen to the show, and then look them up. So it is Whiskey Life, which is WISCY_LIFE. Check them out. Show them a little love. And let's get started here. We'll bring the guys in. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Hey, Brad. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Brad.
Absolutely. So we got Tress, Josh, and Jimmy on. It's three of them out of Arizona here. I'm really excited to have you guys on because I know nothing about hunting Arizona, so I'm really excited to pick your guys' brain on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're glad to be here.
I mean, coming from Wisconsin, like looking at Arizona, like looking at like the different country, and I've been there before, like the desert, the high country, like it's like, whoa, I'm used to that. But before we get into there, let's talk about like how you guys got started hunting. Like, let's go back to when you, like, did you start when you were kids? Did you start as adults? Did you take it on yourself? Like where'd you start? Like, what got you into what drives us all outdoors?
All right. Go ahead, Josh.
So I started, I was probably in fourth or fifth grade, and I lived in Arkansas, and I was hunting squirrels. I was hunting all kinds of small game, including Bob Whites there. And then it was a lot of fun. I didn't have a dog. You'd just see them. You'd see the Bob Whites running around and you'd see turkey and white-tailed deer and squirrels of wildlife. And then moved to Arizona when I was in eighth grade and started hunting the Gamble's quail. And back then when I was hunting them, you didn't even need a dog. You just drive down the dirt roads and you'd see the quail running across the dirt roads.
And so so was the population that high then, or was there just that much less pressure?
I think it was a little bit of both. Like, all right. The population was a lot higher then. We were getting better rains. And I don't think as many people were hunting them like they are today. I just remember driving in some of the areas that I drive today, and the numbers were a lot higher back then. And sure. You just see the coveys or a covey run across the road, and you park the truck and head out after them and get a few, and then drive in the truck a little bit further, a couple miles down the road, and see another covey. So it was a lot of fun. And then when I got the bird dogs, it just took it to a whole nother level. It's so much fun.
It's something amazing that the dog brings in. I mean, the dog changes the entire aspect when it comes to bird hunting.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, awesome, man. I like the fact you got after it young and you kind of grew up doing it. That's great. Like, but I got to ask, when you were in Arkansas, like, do you ever get after the timber ducks, man? Like, that's a truly bucket list hunt for me, is timber ducks down south Arkansas.
You know what's cool? So we had 55 acres down there, and I took it for granted, but I remember seeing every year, certain times of the year, I'd see the flock of geese flying over, as well as we'd get wood ducks that'd come and jump on our ponds. And
all right.
Those things were very wildly, like they were very skittish. You had to really sneak in on the pond, and they had good vision, and by the time I tried to jump up, they were gone. And there's always usually just a pair, so you'd see the drake and the hen. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. But I never really got into upland or waterfowl hunting there. But there was plenty of them there.
Oh yeah, it's a bucket list hunt. It's up there on my list. I mean, there's a couple bucket list hunts, and that one's on it for sure. That will happen one day. Who wants to go next? I mean, you got to tell.
I'll go. I grew up in northern New Mexico, just north of Santa Fe. Started hunting really in my backyard, did wild rabbits. I saw some quail here and there. But my dad and my cousin, my uncles were all big game hunters, so I'd go with them often. I didn't get my own tags until I was a little late, older in life. 17.
Do you take a break in there for a little bit? Like, do you stop going with, or do you just...
No, I went with them the whole time, but I never got my own tag, only because I was always in trouble. That's what they would take away from me when when my grades were terrible. So they'd be like, "Oh, you can't, you're not getting a tag this year." So I did it to myself.
Sorry to bring up the bad memories, man.
No, it's all good. It's what made me, so it's all right. So I grew up big game hunting, and then not till I moved out here to Arizona did I start getting to upland hunting. I dropped the big game hunting mostly because I didn't know where to hunt out here. The rules were different. The regulations were different. So I really stopped hunting for a little bit. When I was on my birthday, probably about 10, 11 years ago, my chocolate lab died on my birthday.
Ooh.
And she was my fishing buddy. We'd go fishing all the time. All
right.
We didn't hunt, but after that, we decided that we wanted another dog. I didn't know what breed to get. I didn't want another lab because the labs are pretty big. I love the dogs. I love labs. I just decided I wanted
to. I got a lot of love for a lab, man. This weekend is the 1 year anniversary of mine passing. We're going to go spread some ashes back at the campground. So I got a lot of love for a lab. But no, I get it. I mean, there's so many other dog breeds out there. There might be one that's better for you, better for your hunting style. I no longer have a lab. I have a wired hair Griffon. But I get it, man. But I still got that love for my lab.
I love labs, but just not at this point in my life.
Right.
So I started looking for different breeds of dogs that are kind of similar to a lab. And somehow I ended up finding Brittany.
Okay.
And we bought a started or 2.5-year-old Brittany. And that forced me to start hunting. I mean, he was trained. He's my pet, and he's our house dog. But I was like, you know what? Let's start quail hunting.
Right.
So that's how I got in. It's been crazy since then.
But I get it. I get the fact of like a dog driving you to like change what you do and how you hunt too. Because like my lab, I was total waterfowl obsessed when I got him. Lab duck dog. Right.
Yeah.
He was super high strung, and you could get him steady. He was steady in a blind, not as steady as I would like, but he was steady in a blind to where but in the woods for grouse and woodcock, he was an animal. Like, he was phenomenal. Like, he was so aggressive and so hard charging, yet would stay in range. Like, he was one of them special dogs, but I'm really, really nervous that he's going to be that one dog in my life where it's like, wow. You know what I mean? Like, because you have that, everyone says you get that one dog, and I'm, and if he would be it, that's great. But I'm really hoping at 38 that I get one more wow dog.
Right.
But I mean, I completely feel that. Like, I completely get that. Where you bought a starter dog, and you're like, hey, I might as well do what this dog is really good at. So let's just get up in the uplands.
Yep.
I get
it. Yeah, you're saying about that once in a lifetime dog, Blake, my younger Brittany. I worry that he's going to be that one because I haven't done him any justice. Like, he is bred well. He is hard-nosed. His nose is just phenomenal. And he is strung tight when he's out there and chasing birds. He loves it. And as far as my lack of training skills for myself, I hope I didn't sell him short on that.
All trainers give themselves a hard time. So there's always, it's so easy to judge yourself based on other dogs that you've never actually hunted over or seen in person, but you see these amazing hunt test videos or this or that, and there's some phenomenal dogs out there. But I think a lot of people who train their own dogs that take it seriously and use like different like tools and like NAVDA and all these other things to like help them succeed, I think we're all way too hard on ourselves for the most part.
Yeah, probably.
And I also think we have a very jaded view of everyone like, oh, that dog is perfect, when odds are all you saw was it's one perfect run in its life and not the hundreds of times it made the same wrong and didn't do it right. I mean,
right.
Because we see it all. Because especially if we're the one training the dog, we see every mistake. We see every success. We see all the failures. We have all the pride, all the joy, and all the letdown because we're the ones hands-on, right?
Yeah.
So don't be so hard on yourself, man. I mean, if you're thinking that's a once-in-a-lifetime dog, I mean, you got to be doing something right if that's your first thoughts already. It's your younger one.
Yeah, he's four, and, I mean, we'll see. We'll see. He's fun. He pushes me for sure.
Yeah, it makes you go a couple extra miles.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Big running hard charge of Brittany. I like it.
Yeah. He's scary sometimes. How far he goes, I'm like, when he was younger, now he's calmed down a lot. But the first couple years were.
Yeah. Well over the horizon.
Oh, yeah.
One hill, two hill, I can't see the third hill.
Yeah, how am I going to tell my family I'm not bringing the dog back, right?
Oh, yeah. I've had that thought before, not with my dog, but the guy I had on last week, my grouse hunting buddy, like from 12th year grouse camp this year, his dog is deaf. He's got a deaf English setter. So when so we hunt over her, and like he's got it trained, but you'll see there's times when that dog is like, I don't know where to look to find you, even though you're buzzing my collar. And right. She gets turned around like there was one time she started running the wrong way. I'm like, and like, I can only imagine what his heart did because my heart stopped. And I looked at my lab. I'm like, you have no idea what I'm saying. And I'm trying to like, go get her. Go get her. And she wouldn't because he didn't know what I wanted. I never trained her to go rescue a dog. Right. That's not in my training protocol. I'm like, right. Hey, go fetch up that dog. No, that wasn't in there. Like I'm trying to send him back through the woods and he gets a bird sent. He's like, oh, bird, that's what you wanted. I'm like, no, Ember, running the wrong way. But I can only imagine what he felt. And she got figured out. But I mean, I know that feeling of like, I can't imagine not coming home with my dog. It's like, whoa. That's I'm a big fan of GPS collars these days.
They're amazing.
I love having that long leash on them.
Yep.
Yes.
So, well, how about you, my story.
All right. How about you, Mr. Jimmy? How'd you get into this all? How'd you join this crazy world?
I kind of started back east. I was from Pennsylvania, and we left there. My dad moved us out to Arizona when I was 10, but right at that age, all the neighbor kids were starting to turkey hunt. I got a year and a half old Brittany pup that loves making me do stuff right now. But hey, but yeah, so when we moved out here, my dad was a big hunter back there, and we just started, you know, it wasn't right when I was 10. I had to earn it a little bit. So probably about 12, I started just going out, me and my cousin and my dad and his partner, he had a machine shop, and his machine shop partner, the four of us would go out and started with small game. And then we put in for the deer draws, and I hunted deer and elk when I was a kid. Never shot anything. Shoot, I hunted probably 6 or 7 tags before I filled one at age 30, you know, being drawn for big game. But you know, that's what kind of when I think of my happy times of my childhood, it's out there in the woods with my dad and just stomping around. That was before we had a lab at the house that was a, you know, a house dog. It never went, but I went into the military and stopped hunting for a couple years. You know, I tried college a couple years and still hunted during that. And then I went to the military and was actually stationed in New Mexico also. I met my lovely wife up in the military, and her dad was a hunter. And I started hunting in Lordsburg, New Mexico, kind of the, what would you say, southwest, Trace? Probably the southwest New Mexico with him. shooting some scalies and some gambles down there. And then I always wanted my own lab. So when we got out of the military, I bought my first lab, and it just, you know, basically labs are the easiest for, you know, I can say, you just teach them to retrieve. They love to do that. You know, if you can keep them in the area, they're naturally going to hunt for
it. Oh, yeah. I mean, you get a hard chart. I mean, you get a lab with a strong retrieve drive, you can teach them anything. I mean, you don't need another reward. That retrieve is such a great reward. I mean, they're such a forgiving dog to train too. Like, you can have kind of a bad day and be maybe a little too aggressive or a little too much pressure on your training method, and 30 seconds later, their tail's wagging, they're licking your face like, it's okay, don't feel bad, I'm fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so I had that, and then I was hunting by myself. I really got my lab because I really couldn't get anybody to go up hunt with me at that point. You know, I moved back here and we bought our house, so I hunted a lot of gambles with her. And then my father-in-law, about every other year, we started going to Nebraska. He was in the military also, and he had been stationed in Nebraska when his kids were younger. So me, him, and my brother-in-law, we'd go to Nebraska and hunt pheasants. So we took my lab along, and we did her there probably 4 or 5 years, and she was the only dog. And then probably about the third time, he was always talking about Britneys. They had Britneys growing up. So I had actually seen a guy running a German short hair in a lab together, a single guy in a field. We were parked up above watching them, and it was just awesome seeing that GSP out in front of them. And in that lab, you know, 30 yards or 20 yards in front of them, just hunting close. And I just fell in that love with that, that option, so to speak. Sure. There. So I came home and excuse me, found a litter of Brits, and I bought two. I bought a female for myself, and I bought my father-in-law a male. He was actually stationed in Mississippi at that time, so I think he paid more for the plane ticket to get this dog back to Mississippi than I did for the dog. But yeah, that was my first one. She's now retired. She's 13, in deaf, but she's just an old lady. She hangs out at the house, and
enjoying those retirement years, man. You got to give her that occasional treat and the cheeseburgers and the biscuits and everything else.
Yeah, she's living the life. She doesn't like this pup too awful much. I mean, they're all over each other. But I hunt three dogs, and then I have the old retired one. I have a 9-year-old Brittany, a 6-year-old yellow lab that I run, and then now I got a 1.5-year-old Brit. And we take the 9-year-old's got one more good year in him. Well, he might have more than that, but he's starting to get old. So I put in for late deer and elk hunts, which we didn't get drawn for. I'm going to Nebraska either opening week or as soon as I get the word that they cut corn. And
sure,
I'm going to take him on his, that's where his first hunt was in Nebraska. And I'll make sure he has at least one of his last ones up there. And then he'll hunt part-time. He'll go to part-time retirement, and I'll run my lab and my 1.5-year-old Brit with Trace and Josh.
And sure.
That's what I love it, man. And the training, you know, we got people that help us out, but you know, I train them all myself. And the first Brit was my first pointer. She was hard. I mean, it was just natural for her. She wasn't great. The second one's a little bit better. This third one, she is tremendous. You know, I think she's going to be great. Better breeding, you know, we started looking into bloodlines and
sure
ability there. And she's right up there with Trace maybe. And I'm hoping that it's my patience that got her that way also, and we can keep on pressing on with
a little more experience, dogs, a little more experience with training, kind of seen some of the pitfalls, some of the successes. I mean, it all adds up, right? I mean, as much as we watch our dogs grow, I mean, as much as we teach them, they're teaching us. Everyone's heard that in the dog training world, but I've learned more from my dog than I think I've taught it.
Oh, and my thing is anything wrong with that dog, I did that, you know. There's
right.
The dog was flawless before I touched it, you know. So, she's going to be terrific. My lab, I love running that lab. That lab does real well at retrieving and staying fairly close, and that Brit will get out there. I mean, don't get me wrong. She hunted 1 year, and the first half of this last year was sight hunting and chasing butterflies and just as far as they could go. But towards the end, she started turning it on, and Had a couple good points. Yeah, it was good.
So, yeah, that's always real natural.
That's always exciting to watch. I mean, like Trace just said, a real natural dog. I mean, it's just really exciting to watch that puppy start to go like transition from, oh my God, the whole world is so exciting, to that focus, like where they're starting to bring that focus in and they're like, I'm out here to find these birds. And then you get that first real point, not a sight point, not like a false point, like that first real point where it's like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And then like everything like for you is like, oh my God, she's doing what I taught her to do, or he's doing what I taught her to do. And it's just a great little like harmony, like that start, like, I mean, that's the building blocks of what we all do.
Yeah, I love it when they flip the switch. She flipped the switch and now she knows. And now you can really correct it. Well, one thing I did learn about the Brits is they are super soft. Like you said, like you can be a little bit more, I mean, you can just raise your voice at those Brits and there's no need to do anything more than that with them. They seem to be a lot softer than your block-headed lab and stuff like
sure.
that. Sure. So it's different, but luckily I'm older and more patient. You know, I mean, you just grow. You grow. I've grown as a man, and hopefully, you know, I can give these guys the best life. And again, like Trey said, it's my duty to get them out. That's what they love to do. They right. live for that. Mm-hmm. That's what... I can't drag my butt out of the bed on the weekend at 5 in the morning. I'm going to do it just to get them out and just hike, walk with them if that's what it takes.
I mean, that's a big reason why I don't big game hunt. I mean, the archery hunting in Wisconsin's got long traditions. I'm a late onset hunter. I took up hunting at myself. I think I was 22 at that time. No one in my family hunted. I was renting a farmhouse with a friend. And there was just ducks and geese piling in the field, which I'm like, all right, well, let's start with, I call the farmer up. I'm like, hey, can I have permission to hunt your field? I don't care. Well, okay, let's go get hunter safety taken care of and let's go hunt this field. So we started waterfowl hunting. And then my father-in-law now he's a big deer hunter. He doesn't do anything else, but that waterfowl drive drove me to like upland hunting. And it's all about the dog for me. Like I enjoy, okay, like I've settled down enough now being older that I can sit in a tree stand and actually be patient enough and actually truly enjoy the experience. But I'd much rather be hunting behind my dog anytime I can, any opportunity absolutely. I have.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think I'd quail hunt without a dog. Actually, I know I wouldn't quail hunt without a dog. Yeah,
I don't really think I would either.
I wouldn't bird hunt without a dog. I mean, if I've lost my dog and I wasn't able to get one for a period of time, I'd go to start big game hunting. As much as I love bird hunting, I just can't envision doing that without a dog. That's so integral to the entire experience. And I've talked about this before on my shows, but to me, it's all about the experience. It really is. Like, it's not about limits. It's not about dead bird. I mean, it's about the entire hunt and the experience and the emotions of it, everything. And if I don't have that dog aspect, that's like 80% of the reason I'm out there, if not more. Like without right. that, it's kind of like, okay, if I'm gonna walk right. through the woods, I might as well go for a hike. Yeah. Why carry a shotgun? Absolutely. That was just extra weight.
Right. Yep.
So let's look, what's the difference, like dog training? Like I know like you run like big, like, well, I guess let's talk about Arizona. Let's back it up even a farther step. Like, what's the covers you guys are hunting? Like, you're talking about quail, and you've named three kinds of quail. Like, how many kinds of quail do you have, and what type of habitat are they in?
We have three huntable quail. Okay. Gambles, the typical topknot quail that everyone sees. We got the scaled quail and also merns. Gambles are down here in the lower desert. Scaled quail are a little bit higher elevation, and then merns are like at what, 4,000 or 5,000 feet up?
Yeah,
5,000 feet. So, those are the three huntable birds we got.
Don't they have some pockets of California quail you were telling me about, Trace?
There are they some do. Pockets of California quail, and also we have the mastabob white, which is endangered species.
Okay.
In just one little area of Arizona.
So you actually have five species then there. Like, so are they all a breeding population then?
No, five species with four huntable species. The mastabob white's on the endangered.
Got it.
Right.
But there's still a breeding pipe. Like, does Does the DNR like do anything for like planting quail or anything like that, or is this all wild producing birds?
All wild producing.
Okay.
Yep.
So our pheasant program in Wisconsin, which I don't hunt it because I think it's a waste of time personally, but it's all planted birds.
Right.
I mean, because the pheasant, because we just don't, the habitat's been lost for so long, and with the change in farming practices and not having that tall cut corn to give habitat in the winter, and farmer, and nothing against farmers, I support them 100%, but like farming practices have just changed where it's taken some of that habitat away, and then the housing boom and everything, there just isn't enough habitat for a breeding population anymore without some serious focused efforts, and we just don't have it.
Right.
I think a lot of Pennsylvania's like that too. I still got family back there, and they plant birds out there, and they ditch hunt them most of the time.
Like, yep.
That's fine. That's great, but it's a lot different with the wild birds, like you're saying. You know, you get the South Dakota for pheasant, or you know, like we do Nebraska, but Kansas, all those are supposed to be phenomenal destinations for wild birds. That's what we
mean. Oh, absolutely, for wild pheasants. And like northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan, northern Minnesota is all like great destinations for woodcock and grouse, and those are all wild. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, so you have the five types of quail, four are huntable. Do you have any other upland species up there that you chase? Like in the high mountains, like do you get any like blue grouse or sage grouse or like any of those?
We have areas of blue grouse.
All right.
Yep.
We also have a chukar up by the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And there's a small population of duskies or blue grouse up there as well. But yeah, chukar and grouse.
You got like a whole like kind of like melting pot of birds. I like it. Like you kind of like depending on which way you want to go, you almost can chase something different.
Yeah, it's nuts. They got pheasant down south, right down toward Juma. They got.
You're right. Yeah.
They got a pheasant population down there, huntable, but it's almost like a big game. You got to draw a tag, and they give you two rooster pheasant tag. You know,
sure.
During a period, which, I mean. Still a population that you can hunt down here if that's what you really wanted to do.
That's crazy. I didn't realize there were pheasants that far south. Like I had no idea on that one.
I forget they're down there too.
I always think of pheasant as like a Midwest bird. I really do. Like your Dakotas, your North Dakotas, your South Dakotas, which was the capital forever. And then Iowa's got a good population. And then, like as you said, Nebraska and Kansas are known for it as well. And I never would have put Arizona on my radar to like go for pheasant ever.
Yeah
it will never be on anyone's radar out here.
I won't hunt them.
So what I mean, we've talked like, so you have quail in the southern part, then quail at 5,000 feet. Like what's the terrain differences? Like are you like what are you dealing with terrain with between yourself and your dogs?
So in the desert the desert quail, you're down in the low desert cactus. A lot more cactus, a lot more rock, a lot more thorns, you know, prickly pear, saguaro cactuses, things like that, those kind of challenges. And then when you get up to the scaled quail, you're kind of more in a, like, grassland. But there is a few Cholla cactus out there, but it's more like rolling grassland is what it reminds me of. And then you go from there up into where the Mearns quail are, which is, there's grassland, but there's also... There's quite a few oak trees where they hang out, and it's a lot steeper canyons, and it's not as rugged as I would say as Gamble's quail country, but there's very steeper canyons and a lot more trees, and that so it makes your shooting lanes a lot harder when you're shooting in those trees.
So like when you're hunting Gamble's, because that's low country, right? So
yeah,
Gamble's low country. All right. So, like, are you guys booting dogs? Are you, like, forceps for, like, all, like, they have to run in the occasional cactus, right? Or cacti or whatever you got, cat plural, whatever. So, I'm like, are you guys booting dogs? And, like desert makes me think snakes. Like, what are you guys doing to, like, help with all that? Like, how are you getting ready, like, or preparing your dogs for it? And what do you bring with you, like, for those situations when you're hunting this low country, rugged terrain for, like, Mearns quail?
Well,
for the Gamble's quail is
Gamble's,
in low
sorry,
color.
Gamble's. Yeah.
No, you're good.
I'll keep up eventually, probably not.
For me personally, I do boot my dogs. I know some guys don't. I use Lewis dog boots. They're very rugged and they can handle a good chunk of the rough terrain. You will occasionally get thorns, long prickly pair of thorns that make it through those boots.
Sure.
And then, but at the end of the day, at the end of the hunt, your dog's going to still have some thorns you'll have to go pick through. The other tough one that you don't really want to grab is a Choya. And so what I carry with me is just a cheap comb, and I can get, using that cheap hair comb, just flick off the pieces of Choya right off the dog. So you don't have to worry about that.
So like just a regular human hair comb is what you're rolling?
Yeah. Yeah,
have you used any of like the metal combs actually meant for dog grooming? Have you seen those? It's because that's what I like with having a wired hair and burrs. That is my favorite too. That and a Mars cocaine. I mean, that's right there too. But that comb, I have one in my dog training bag. I have one in my dog grooming bag. I have one in my upland vest. Like that metal comb is like a lifesaver because I've had my dog come out of a thicket chasing woodcock with so many burrs in her eyes and in her beard and on her face, she can't see. Like she literally cannot see, and she's just coming to the sound of my voice at that point because all of her hair is just a solid burr, like hair mat, and it's terrible. And I take the time right there and clean it out so she can see. Well, not 100%, I'll just kind of clump back to its sides to give her some vision, tell her to get going again. And we'll take care of the rest of the truck because Cowboy Magic's also another really great tool with a wired hair. But interesting that you could just flip those out with a plastic comb. Like you don't need any like strength behind it.
No,
it needs to have a little bit of stability, but not much.
Interesting. Right, so you don't have to like rip them out or tear them out. They just kind of get hung up in the hair then, or are they actually in the skin?
Oh no, they go in the skin.
They're in the skin. They're not barbed as much like you would think of like porcupine needles or anything. They just, you can flip them out and they stay pretty clumped up together. Like
okay.
It doesn't lose its needle. It's like a whole ball, like, you know, plant vegetation with a whole bunch of needles on it just pops out. But
got it. So like a whole bunch, like the base of it, almost the base kind of stays with it as well.
Yep.
That makes sense. Like from just like a plant repopulation standpoint too, because all the seeds go with it. I get it now.
And we carry our needle nose pliers also because needles will get stuck in and you got to go in there and pull them out of the dog or your friend's butt, depending.
Do you have to worry about those needles burrowing in? Like, is that a concern? Like up here, like we have foxtail grass that can get stuck in a dog and burrow, like to the point where it's lethal, where they'll burrow all the way through the skin into the bloodstream, into the heart. Like it's a legitimate deal because it's a thorned barb. Well, it's not a thorn barb, but it's a grass on that's barbed that doesn't like to go backwards, so it works through the skin. Like, do you have any of that issue, like, with your cacti out there? Like, is that the same thing where you have to, like, get them out within a certain amount of time where they'll keep burrowing in, or?
No.
I don't think so. I mean.
Like all right.
That
sounds nicer.
Like, you'll get the dog that'll try to pull it out from its, you know, it'll reach back and try to pull its own stuff out, and its mouth will be completely bloody, and you just get in there and get what you can, and that acid in their mouth dissolves a good portion of it. Correct, Trace? Josh, don't you agree that? I mean, you get what you can, and the dog presses on versus those foxtails. Yeah, those foxtails are super bad.
They're nasty.
And we run into a little bit of that stuff out here, but we're real cautious on that. The other, like, what I would say is all of our pups, we almost get all of our pups snake trained, like you said. An initial time where you take them to a trainer and get it snake trained, and then you bring it back about a year later and get a refresher training on it. So we can hunt before the real freeze. I mean, the hunting season will start, and, you know, if you don't do that, like, I won't hunt dove in September. It's just too hot, too snaky. Once the real upland gets going, you know, I like to be there. I like to get out there and do it as much as I can, but it's not worth, you know, that's our protection right there. Wouldn't you agree?
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I used to take them out right at the very beginning of the season, but I didn't see a lot of rattlesnakes, but I did see snakes, and that let me know that there were snakes out. So I've been recently just waiting until it starts cooling off where I know the snakes are lethargic. They're not going to be doing much. You know, you still have a chance of getting your dog getting bit by a snake, but it goes way down come December.
Sure.
You know, in hibernation.
Oh, I mean, like, you guys are talking, like, see, that's just crazy for me to even wrap my head around. Like, you guys are talking about December. Like, my season's ending in December. And yours is finally getting cool enough to hunt your dog. So, like, how long, like, when does your season start? Like, does different quail start at different time depending on area and then, like, go through different times, like, depending, obviously, on areas that, like, season specific? Are there region specific seasons, I guess, is what I'm saying?
No, we got gambles and scalies start in October.
Yeah, mid-October.
Mid-October and then end in February. And then Mern starts in December. And it ends the same time as Scaly and Gambles do. So it's shorter season.
But you got them, Pop. If you hunt that warmer season, if you don't wait that late, I mean, you got five solid months of hunting almost?
Oh, absolutely.
So
not to mention if you want to go grouse hunting in September, I mean, there's that. So we got a lot of hunting
up north, it's cooler up there, so.
Yeah.
Sure. Do you have, like, so, like, with us with grouse hunting, our season starts mid-September, but mid-September's terrible. Not even with, like, the heat and the bugs, that's all garbage, but we have too many leaves on the tree. Like, it's so hard to actually get shooting opportunities because all the leaves are on the trees, all the ferns are up. Like, you, like, do you have those issues, like, when you hunt early? Like, are you waiting for foliage to, like, fall at all, or is it kind of like the same country all year round?
No, are you talking grouse or quail?
All of it, man. We're talking Arizona.
Right? All right. I think grouse, I don't know if any of us have too much experience as far as worrying about the foliage and stuff like that. We're just going out there to try it out. As far as the gambles, it's everything's low. Everything's low. Yeah. Everything stays the same. You're not worried about the trees because there's very few mesquite trees or anything out there.
If anything, we're waiting for the blooms on the prickly pear fruit. We'll look at the fruit on the cactus. And you'll shoot quail that'll have completely purple beaks. Their whole face will be purple because all they're doing is eating that fruit off of the prickly pear fruit off the off that. But as far as, like, we're pretty much evergreen. The cactuses stay there. The mesquite trees stay green. So the density we just watch out for is the density of the cholla cactus. I mean, you can watch a cubby run into a patch of cholla and you're like, we're not going in there because you'll spend way more time. You know, my lab was so smart. Like, she would walk behind me. No, I'm not going. You go first and I'll go ahead and follow you. So,
I know what that stuff is. I'm staying out of there. You blaze that trail there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, I'll think a dog is on point, and I'll go see if it's on point, and no, it's in cactus. It just stops. The dog does not move. He's like, all right. So come, it's either on point or in a bunch of cactus.
Come get me. Pick me up. I need help.
Exactly. Yep.
I like it. It's weird on how smart or how well those dogs adapt. They'll know the different types of cactus. They'll stick their head completely in the prickly pear, the elephant ear type cactus, because they don't release their, you know, their thorns so much, so to speak, versus getting into the cholla or the dead cactus that are falling down. They'll stop on that stuff, but you'll see our Brittany's will damn near climb inside after a bird and different type of cactus. And it's still, to us, we're still getting poked all the time, but
sure.
They're crazy.
So what do you guys run for gear then, Mike? What's your go-to, like, pant? Or, like, okay, we talk snakes. So are you guys, like, wearing rattlesnake boots? Are you wearing rattlesnake chaps? Like, what, like, when you guys are hunting, like, what's your go-to setup for, like, not only safety, but the comfort and mobility?
I just wear jeans, but I wear some chaps over top of them, and they're just some thin ones. I bought rattlesnake ones. I have them. They're just so thick. I mean, it's warm, man. Your pants will be completely wet, but I like a brush type guard chaps because I'll blaze through a lot of scrub oak. We got a lot more scrub oak and stuff like that more like jaggers when we're hunting different places. And then, we dress in layers because you're going to be peeling them off. And
if you've never been, like, I've been to Arizona a couple times, but the temperature swings there blew my mind, especially like in the desert area, like just how hot it got during the day and how cold it got at night. Like you have to dress in layers there. Like I don't see how you couldn't.
Yeah, absolutely. We dress in layers, and then we all, you know, we're all about durable gear. I would say we're all about durable quality gear that we run, and that's really kind of what we do. We're starting to do with Upland, Arizona, is find gear that we like, that we would run for, and we're not sponsored by anybody or anything like that. But right now we're all running Q5 vests, and they just give us multiple. Just they're super durable. I've done 5 seasons of mine, and I carry a ton of stuff. And I'll have it on this next season, and they're just real. That's the best piece of gear that I got, other than my GPS collar. Because before that, I mean, I've had dogs long enough where I was running the Upland beepers, and so you're listening for that beep, and shoot,
sure.
Trace, probably 3 years ago, I was still running a beeper, and I felt embarrassed because these guys are running GPS. It's not because of the collar. Just because my dog's so loud running by everybody beeping. But it is coming from a lab to a pointer that it can run. I'm kind of a control freak. I want to know where they're at, you know.
Sure.
I really do. So, but that's what I'm running, really, just the Q5 vest and then tons of water and stuff like that. What are you running, Josh?
I do the Q5 vest as well. I've been wearing jeans, but recently I bought a pair of these Orvis Upland pants, and they're...
Ooh, now you're talking my language.
Super comfortable. I couldn't believe the difference, how comfortable those pants are. Breathable, and it's perfect for here in Arizona, just having that comfort to go through a barbed wire fence and to walk around all day and not have any issues. And then I also carry the Garmin GPS. That thing's been... absolutely well worth its money to have that. And then the rest is just lots of water. I bring maybe a water bottle or so for me, but the rest of the water is for the dogs. Because, you know, you never know if you're going to come to a stock tank and it's empty, and you just need to keep them hydrated as much as possible.
And the empty stock tanks have been happening a lot more lately.
They have.
So... I'm assuming those aren't filled by water. Like, well, they're filled with water, obviously, but they're not filled by rain, the stock tanks. I'm assuming it's a well or a farmer pumping into them.
No, it's
usually rain.
Rainwater.
Oh, really? All right.
Yeah.
A lot of times we'll call them like trick tanks, where they make like a catchment, and they'll run it into a one, and it just cascades into another type deal. But they call them trick tanks or stock tanks like that.
Right.
Okay. Interesting.
I run the Q5 vest also. That thing is
okay. Handy. So I got, hold on, like, not to cut you off, I gotta ask, so who bought the first Q5 and talked everyone into it? Who's the salesman?
Trace.
Trace.
All right, so we're back to you. What was the factor, man? What did it?
Well, just the amount of stuff I was able to carry, how comfortable it was, how durable it was. I mean, my friend, they're trainers, they're dog trainers, and they put, when their dogs get tired, they put the dogs in the bag. I mean, that's, and you don't feel it on your shoulders. All the weight's on your hips,
sure,
which makes it an all-day pack. And does it help that I met I know the founder of Q5. So Dan and I became pretty good friends after a while. So that helped.
I've seen their vests. They look really, really solid. It's not what I'm currently running, but they look like a super solid vest.
They are. Brad, Dan did a great job building these.
Brad, I'm pretty sure that I caused his great friendship, because he showed it to me, and then I was like, I got to get one. And then I bought 5 vests in 1 year. I bought 3 Christmas gifts, me, my brother-in-law, my father-in-law. I met Dan at the Quail Forever banquet, and I was like, hey, you're Dan Priest. He's all... Yeah, I said, I'm your best customer you've had. He's like, what are you talking about? I said, I bought 5 vests this year. You know, I got to be up there. And he's all, you might be my best customer right there.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, last year I went through a couple of different vests, and they were on my list. But for me, that was just, for you guys, it's great, because, like, you carry so much gear. For me, in the grouse and the woodcock country, especially, I want a super small, super thin, low profile, ultra tight to me vest. Like, I don't even bring an entire box of shells with me on a normal day. I mean, two water bottles, because I mean, I'm normally not that far from the truck. I'm not going, well, there's some spots I'm going miles in, but for the most part, we're able to like go, like, I'll pick covers apart. So I think the Q5 looked like a solid vest, but for me, it just seemed a little too big.
Right. So
I understand.
Now that we're going to get into this, I guess we're going to do a vest review.
All right.
We got our hands on Q5 Rimfire. We got a hold of one of the Pike vests.
Sure, man.
Yeah, we got a hold of Chief Upland.
Yep. That's Final Wisconsin Rise. Right there, man. That's made in Wisconsin.
Final Rise.
Okay.
I mean, so we've got a handful.
Now, hold on. I'm going to back you up real quick because there's two vests I've had the past 2 years, and I didn't hear them on your list. So I had the Orvis Pro, which is a little too big, but now I've got the Orvis Pro Lite, which is amazing. Like, for me, you got to try one of the Orvis, man. You got to figure out a way to get your hands on one. Like, I want to see that in the review. You don't have to. I mean, whatever.
Well, if you want to send me yours, that'd be cool. We can do that.
I already sent the regular Pro back, which would be on you, because I'm not sponsored by Orvis at all. No way. Right. Nowhere near. I ran that vest for a year. I didn't like it. They took it back. Yeah. Like, that's solid.
Right. Yeah.
They have some of the best customer service I've ever seen. They're
awesome. Now, I did buy another one from them right away. But, I mean, that was just like, the one thing I couldn't get over is my shotgun mount with the shoulder strap is a little too big, but I'm not trying to carry as much weight as you guys. So rather than me trying to figure out how to work around a thicker strap, I just don't want any straps, but I know I have to have them. So I just went with a thinner one.
Sure. Right. And we're doing our reviews there, and we see some of those that's a big thing. Who is it? Final Rise? It has like the, no, it's the,
Pike.
Sorry, the one that has like the seatbelt type material.
I believe that's Pike.
Yeah, Pike.
Man, those shoulder straps were amazing. I mean, they just sit tight against your shoulder, and terrific.
I will tell you, our review's not done yet, but that's not a bad vest.
I mean, unless you're gonna throw this up, like this episode doesn't like it. It's airing a little at a later date because I'm actually a little ahead of schedule. Believe it or not, listeners, I'm ahead of schedule for once. So unless your rest review is going to be done like within the next month, don't spill any beans. We'll just point everybody to go like watch your Instagram and Facebook and everything else.
No, I won't say too much, but there's not a bad vest in any of them. I think we went with these because with these different brands because they're not big companies like Orvis.
Right.
You got all these starter companies that are out there, and not everybody, you can't go to a store and find these vests.
This is true.
So we wanted to get a hold of these and tell everyone else how we felt about them, our thoughts on them, if we're good, if we would use them, just in general, just so they know that these are good products or not good products. But like I said, they're all pretty good. You just got to pick which one is best.
Budget and everything else, and yep, I get it. I mean, everyone's got its own little design features, right? Like the Pike gear. Like I looked hard at that one because I really like that seatbelt vest thing. Yeah. I remember I looked hard at Q5. I looked hard at a couple of their different vests. I looked at Chief Upland. It was too vest for me. Like I've talked to the guy, super cool guy. I love the fact he's from Wisconsin. I support him as much as I can. But I'm a strap vest guy. I'm not a traditional vest guy. That's not me.
Right.
Understood completely.
But I mean, that vest is really cool with all the Molly, and that gets super adjustable. You can strap whatever you want to it, and any accessory you can think of that's Molly based can go on that vest. That's an awesome idea.
Yep.
But it's just too vest. I don't know what to describe it, man.
You know what? I think we could say this here. It's probably too warm for us.
Yeah,
out here.
We want to be able to strip it down on and this type deal. Yeah, we agree. But it would be a great vest for other locations, I'd say too.
Yeah,
it'd be great. I mean, I think it's a great pheasant vest, like for the Dakotas or something. Like, and it's a great vest if you want something ultra customizable too. And I don't want to get too far in depth on just this one vest. So. But I'm not trying. I just want to make sure like no one out there's like, oh, you don't like Chief Upland. It's nothing like that. I mean, it's just a personal preference for me. I like a strat. I like a super ultra tiny small strat vest that can hold a box of shells, my GPS transceiver for my dog trip pathfinder. I carry an IFAC with me and a small dog first aid kit because I want to because I hunt so much solo. I have a tourniquet, Israeli bandage. I have quick clot. Like I have a true IFAC for myself personally, and then like a dog version as well. And then I carry enough water for the both of us.
Right.
And that's all I want. I don't want anything more than that. Like I'm not bringing extra clothes or anything like that. I have a spot to strap a jacket to if I have to strip down. But like I said, most of the time I'm going in like 3 miles. Coming back out, and then I can get to my truck, and then I can refill water bottles. I carry a 5-gallon Gatorade with me. I can add more shells, and then I go and attack a different part of the same cover where I'm in.
Right.
So for me, I can almost base camp how I hunt daily. So right. I want a super small one. But what kind of mileage are you guys putting on a day?
Probably 8 to 10, us and the dogs, at least 3 times that.
Yeah.
Sure.
I'd say 8 miles each time we went out.
Yeah, and that's like when you leave the truck to when you get back, like you're not going in between, like, cause I'll do 8 to 10 miles throughout the day. The dog will do about 2.5 times me, but we're back at the truck throughout those periods. Like you guys are just gone and then back.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Like that's something like, and at that point I want a big vest, right? Like I want to be able to carry like 2, 3, 5 gallons of water with me. So what do you like? Go ahead.
No. I just agree. We more water the better.
I mean, that's got to be a huge concern for you guys, right? I mean, yeah. Desert stocks can't rely on stock tanks. Like, how much water are you guys bringing on a hunt for a standard day hunt? You guys do 8-10 miles. How much water are you bringing?
I'm usually running 2 dogs at a time, and I carry 8 of those. What do they think? They're probably 16 ounce water bottles. I carry 8 of those, and then 2 12-ounce water bottles that are for me that are really the dog reserve.
Sure.
So we just really the pouch and it's full of water until you start filling it up with birds. I mean, so that's what I'm running. But we're real obviously when we hunt together. Any dog that comes over to us, you're hosing down. My dog, Josh from Trace. You know, we carry it for the dog. And heaven forbid, if you come and hunt with us, you're going to pack water. I mean, we're just going to load you up whether you want it or not.
Yeah. If you don't have a dog, you're carrying all our water.
Yeah, here's an extra couple for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like it. I like it. Hey, water mule.
Yeah.
But no, it makes sense. I mean, like, without water, you're dead. Like not dead, but I mean, like, you're done. Like, if you have a dog that gets super dehydrated and you have a dog that starts to have heat stroke, I mean, it's a complete, like, so you guys bring any glucose to it? Like honey, peanut butter, honey sandwich or something I always had on me for early season hunting. Like, do you guys have that or glucose? Or like, I mean, heat stroke's got to be a big concern for you guys.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's that big a concern, but Trace got us hooked up with some supplements that we do. What's that? Tell them about
this. It's kinetic. It's the hydration 30K, I think is what it is. That stuff works. And I will tell you, I've seen my dog come back because my dog, the younger one, does not like to come back to the water too much.
Sure.
And I've seen him at the end of the day, just he was peeing. It was brown. It scared the crap out of me. It did not look good. And I loaded him up with some of that. He finally started drinking it and he perked right up. It cleared him up and yeah, I would say it helped him a lot. I know Josh has had some experience with it too, with his, with Ellie.
Yeah.
You can see it work, man.
So, I mean, definitely. You guys are absolutely taking precautions then, because, I mean, you guys have to be conscious of heat stroke. I mean, that's got to, I mean, when we're talking about wearing vests that are light enough so you guys don't overheat, I mean, the dogs have to be, I mean, you can tell just talking. I mean, dogs are a huge concern. So.
Yeah.
Right.
Sometimes if I find a stock tank, I'll just pick up the dog and put him in the stock tank to just cool him off.
Sure.
You know, in the middle of the day, and then we'll just sit there and just got to take breaks. You can't just keep moving. You got to stop and take breaks, sit down in the shade, let them cool off. It's kind of watch your dog, and they'll let you know, okay, I need to rest for a little bit.
Yeah.
I'll do a lot of like, I'll float their food, before, you know, before the hunt, like the night before. And, you know, I'm draining, you know, I'm just soaking their food in water and forcing water that way. Cause none of them will drink when you get them out of the truck immediately. They want to go run. And then about 5 minutes later, they want to drink half the water you
brought sure. in there.
But the key that I do is just every time they come back, I give them a little shot, you know, just keep them from getting to that point where they start to dehydrate. And then, you'll know. The only problem is my big lab, she likes to drink. So
half so the time goes on
my baby girl there, but yeah. So I'll float their water, and then Trace gets us the supplements. It's weird, like those, like my dogs, like they don't want to drink Gatorade; they just want water at all. But we kind of not force it, but you know, we kind of make that available to them every bit, and that's all we need is some electrolytes in them and keep them watered.
Sure. I get the whole, like you say, you don't force your dogs to drink, but I mean, there's been plenty of times I've forced my dog to drink when I'm like, no, I don't care how birdy you are. It has been way too long. We are carrying way too much water still. Like, we've been out too long. You're going to drink, yeah. And I don't care if you start to choke. Well, I do care, but I don't care, because it's like, I'm going to shove this water down your throat. You're either going to choke or you're going to drink it.
Yeah. Right. And I found that if I start spraying their neck and their chest, they'll start wanting water at that point. They'll be like, all right, that feels good. Let's drink.
Sure. And I mean, it sounds like you guys do, like, you're big into training. So, I mean, you guys are what, like, your dogs are staying in shape year round, and like, you probably run them during the heat. I mean, briefly, but I mean, that was a big thing I noticed in Wisconsin, at least, like when summer comes, like there's a lot of people that don't run their dogs. There's a lot of people that don't train with their dogs. I'm sure there's plenty of Arizona too. So I don't want to just blame Wisconsin, but right. I see like you get like, early, like pheasant opens middle of October here, and that's really where a lot of people hunt. I'm not there, but that's where a lot of people hunt with their dogs. And some Octobers here are like in the 80s. I mean, it's just, we get hot falls sometimes.
Right.
And they haven't ran their dogs. Their dogs are half out of shape. They don't know how to read their dogs for heat stroke. And my ex-sister-in-law was a vet. She's a vet. She's an emergency surgeon vet is what she is. She's like, you wouldn't believe how many dogs I've seen for heat stroke for opening of hunting season, because people don't know how to read their dogs or give them enough water, and they're kind of out of shape. So, I mean, that all goes into like what we're talking about with like conditioning your dogs is part of it.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think the worst thing I seen was about 2 years ago, my brother, and this wasn't opening season, but he has a couple Brits that are 8 years old then. And we were running them, just, he brought them down. Let's take them out hunting. She loves to hunt, and she does. And she hunts in Nebraska with us. I don't know the proper term, but she tore both of her front rotator cuffs, like her shoulders, where it was the double surgery. And last year we brought her out, and you know, I, for training, like during the summer, we do train, but I'm lucky enough that I have a neighbor that has a pool.
That oh, nice.
And he likes to go up north to his retirement cabin. So for payment, I clean the pool, and you know, I just take care of the pool. And he has English pointers, so he don't care about dogs enough. So I just swim the dogs every night. I just throw them in there, and you know.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I just kind of keep them. So I brought that dog down all last summer, and swam her every day, and she was good to go for the. But it still ain't right, and you can tell that she walks differently. But yeah, that's just, unfortunately, that's just poor stewardship on our part.
Yep.
For the dog. And after seeing that, it'll never happen to my dogs. You know, I mean, I can't say that, but I will.
And that could have been slightly a fluke incident, right? I mean, like, you don't know, like, 100, but keeping our dogs can do it. Like, it's a big deal. Like, I mean, there's so many people, like, unfortunately, like, that I've seen too, like personally that I know where they're like, oh, we haven't worked at all. We'll just go out hunt duck hunting. And the dogs put on, I don't know, an extra 15 pounds, which for a dog's a lot, right?
Right.
And now you're expecting this dog to go out and do these 100-yard retreats?
Yeah.
When your dog's like gasping for breath, just trying to get in the boat? And I'm sitting there, I'm like, man, like, when was the last time you ran your dog? Like, when was the last time you ran? Right? Because that's how that goes in that conversation, right? Because I'm like, when was the last time, wait a minute, when was the last time you even ran? I'm like, you got to get a belly, right? But right. I mean, like, kind of one of those soft-sided jabs, like, man, your dog's health's important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, I spend months. Once it starts cooling down, your summertime is shot. I mean, unless you're going up north, you're not running your dog, or unless you have a treadmill inside your house.
Sure.
Right now, like we said earlier beforehand, it's 108 and humid. The dog, you don't want to do that to your dog. In the morning, if you wake up at 4:30 in the morning, it's still 90 degrees. So there's really no training for me anyways. I don't run them in that.
We go out about, I don't know, Trace, about every other week we'll go out and we go to a trainer's place and we'll run them in the morning, like a Saturday morning, and we'll put them on a couple, you know, they'll get to do one run.
Short run. Yeah, short run.
45
probably about,
and we'll have two or three planted birds out there, so we're getting constant work with them.
Sure.
That way, but it's not like a conditioning workout there.
Exactly. And right, exactly.
There's and even then, when you start at 7 and you're done by 10, like not that dog, but like all the braces run by 10, there's still probably 4 different water tanks that they got out there for the dogs, every dog to be able to jump in.
Yep.
And they'll do that. But I mean, so we're still trying to keep them on birds, get them to
sure.
back and keep their, you know, keep the technique, keep everything that we instilled, so we don't just lose it for all summer long, like the kids going back to school and can't remember,
right.
you know. So we try to do that. And then, but yeah, that's where I'm kind of blessed, where I get that pool this week, and I'll start taking control of that. And then I'll just get the dogs in the pool for 45 minutes a day and try to keep them that way.
Any of you guys run a treadmill for your dogs? I heard you mention it.
No, I haven't. I've thought about it, but my wife looks at me sideways.
See, I got a treadmill right next to me. I tried to get my dog on it, and mine's a rescue. I rescued her at 6 years old, so I didn't grow up like – I didn't have her as a puppy to expose her to any of this, right? And she's like, absolutely not am I running on that thing.
Right.
It's the whole claws to the death thing, like – nope. I'll tear a nail before I take a step.
I think they should do like a Peloton for dogs. Like have birds in front of them, like a screen, and maybe they'll get them a little excited.
See, you could go like cartoon style with a pigeon on a stick trying to fly away from it the whole time. Like what, right. like maybe not use a treadmill. What, I don't know what they're called, the one where you like run, and the faster you run, the faster it spins. Like there's no
right.
motor, it's just resistance.
Yeah.
Maybe I need one of those with a bird flying, like a literal like pigeon flapping in front of her. Maybe that'll get her going.
There you go.
It'll be like sprint training rather than endurance, but hey, we'll build some muscle.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, Arizona, I mean, it's completely different. I mean, you kind of talked about a little bit of trees in the high country for grouse, which kind of like piques my interest, like for like grouse. Like maybe there's a similarity, but I'm sure there's none. Like it's a completely different environment what you guys are hunting than what I'm used to, like
right.
desert cactus.
You hear that, but then you talk about that Murns country. Everybody that, like, when you hear people that have traveled and seen it, compared to what Wyoming and Montana, like you could lose yourself. It's a completely different environment down there. You get
all right.
down there, it's amazingly different. You know, I like the desert birds, and I love hunting my gambles and all of them. You know, it's just great having the option of doing different stuff on any given weekend type deal. But when people are cold up north, you know, up towards your area, and we're down here hunting in December and January, and we got to shed a layer off because it got a little too warm. It's pretty nice.
In January,
you wear some full leather boots and you're good to go, you know?
I mean, in January, I'm normally sitting on 8 inches of ice chasing crappies and perch. I mean,
and that's not a bad way to do it.
But yeah, I mean,
chasing behind the tail.
I mean, it's definitely, it's on my list. I mean, I've watched some different shows, some different upland hunting shows. One of them focused down in Arizona, and I don't remember what it was or what the show was, but it like really piqued my interest. And like talking to you guys as well, and that later season, it's like maybe one of these years I got to save a little bit of vacation. But with my dog being 10, it's like it's not going to do it. It's not right. Like I got to wait a few years until I have a have a younger dog and we can like have some experience and like really go tackle some of these these bucket list destinations I have. And Arizona's definitely on it because you can hunt 3 or 4 possibly different types of quail, you were saying, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I've never shot a quail in my life.
Oh.
Like, I've never been quail hunting. I take that back. I planted bobwhites. If you want to call that hunting, planted bobwhites for dog training. That's my quail experience.
And that's completely different than, like, these gambles and scalies, they are runners. With a planted bobwhite, that's not moving, right?
No.
These gambles and scalies run. And when they get pretty frustrating.
They move like teal. I mean, you're duck hunting, and you know how those little missile, those teal come in? That's how those quail take off, man. They are, once they blow out, they are moving, too.
In wide open country, too. So it's got to be really hard to possibly, like, it's got to be a distance thing, too, to gauge your shot, right? Because there isn't much for a background to put a distance on there.
That's my problem. That's why I can't shoot. There we go. We found it.
Oh, you just found it, right?
We found it. Thank you, Brad.
I have no distance gauges. I have no reference points. Is that 20 yards or 100? I don't know. Let's shoot.
I'm just shooting. Most of the time behind it.
I don't go out there to save bullets. I really don't. I didn't make that trip to save shotgun shells. So
he's unloading.
Yeah.
Awesome. So what are you guys using for, like, 20 gauge? Yeah, I'm assuming you guys are, like, for the miles you're putting on, you're probably trying to carry pretty lightweight guns, right?
Yeah.
Definitely. I've been carrying a 20 gauge, but I just bought a 28 gauge. See how it goes.
Ooh, he's getting fancy with the low gauge.
Well, now I can have something else to blame on that I can't shoot. So less lead being thrown out there.
You could have just went right to the 410 then, man.
Yeah, well. I want to hit something every once in a while.
Occasionally you want that reward. I got it.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. It's not for you.
The dog just gets mad at me when I miss.
That's why if you can ask Trace, those dogs kind of generate towards me, but I'm shooting like a Ruger Red Label 12 gauge double barrel. So it weighs a ton, but
that's not like
as much pellets out there. So those dogs kind of like to like stay by me because I'm the guy that actually will shoot a little bit more.
Oh yeah, the dogs do gravitate towards Jimmy.
That's awesome. Hey, this guy kills birds. You don't. I'm gonna go hunt.
Yeah, exactly.
I need feathers in my mouth. I know this guy can make it happen. I love it.
Right.
What about you, Josh? What are you shooting?
I shoot a 20 gauge, a Beretta over and under 20 gauge. It's light. It's nice, and yeah, I don't shoot as well as I do with the 12 gauge, but yeah, I still can bring some birds down.
Yeah, Josh is being very modest there. I've seen Josh shoot, and Josh is a good shot. He's really good with that 20, but I'm still not switching. It might be his gun, but I'm still not switching.
Do you know what I give this conversation? No one gave Trace any credit for his shooting abilities. That's all I heard right here.
I was just thinking that. I was like, well.
I hate to tell you this, but Trace ran his dog in a trial a couple weeks ago or a month ago, and he said, "Hey, I want to run the dog. You want to shoot for me?" I said, "Absolutely." Yeah. So, he's all good.
It's a mental thing now, man. It's like I don't even want to shoot anymore. I don't want to. Yeah, I don't want to mess it up for the dogs. I don't, you know. It's just fun.
That's awesome, though. I mean, it's fun, right? At the end of the day, it's all good fun, all good humor. Like, that's the great part about hitting hunt buddies. Like, I don't know you guys yet. I'm going to give you a little bit of a hard time. You're going to give me a little bit of, but I mean, it's all because they have that same camaraderie. And it's really around the dog. I mean, you could say it's around the bird. You could say it around, but at the end of the day, we all share a common bond around our dogs. Is really what I drive it towards, at least.
100%.
I mean, we've all been there and watched that first point.
We got real lucky with I got two good buddies here that all run the same point and breeze, which may be a little weird, but shoot, we're Brittany lovers, and I'm the only guy. I got a big lab, like I said, that she thinks she's a Brittany. She really does. She's never been around another dog that's not been a Brittany, so I'm pretty sure she thinks she's white and orange. But yeah,
that's awesome. My nephew had a Brittany. It was actually a rescue. I somehow wound up in this weird phase where like all my hunting dogs have been rescue dogs. I don't know how that worked out, but we actually drove to West Virginia to pick him up.
All right.
And He hunted for a few years, hunted pretty well, and then as my nephew got older, you know, the college thing, dog got a little older, became more of a family dog. But I mean, it was an awesome dog to hunt behind. It was a great dog.
Yeah.
Yep.
I dig them a lot. I mean,
very affectionate family dog.
Yeah. They just can calm down, and they do shut down a little bit. And at least mine shut down pretty good in the house. And, you know, and they're terrific. I love them. I like them a lot. That's my go-to. But I can't give up my labs, though, still. I mean, I'm gonna run a pair of dogs for as long as I can. You know?
Sure. Yeah. I like it. And if you get a good whistle set down on a lab, and like you get a lab pretty steady, I mean, you can work a pointer and a lab together really, really effectively if you know how to do it.
Yeah, and the e-caller helps me out now because that lab's pretty smart, and she can notice. She can identify a point. And she, oh, that one's on point. And she'll start heading over there because her job is to flush it. And
sure.
It works great for my dogs. Now, Trace's dog is a little bit more steady to shot. And I'm sure okay. It doesn't appreciate my lab kind of bumping through it. And, hey, let me go ahead and flush this bird for you. but everybody's pretty tolerant of her. So it's good.
She's an amazing retriever, man. That dog's got a nose on her, the lab. She's got a nose, and you'll drop a bird, or Jimmy will drop a bird far out, and and that dog will go find her. I mean, when the Brits can't find a down bird, Libby will find it. It's amazing to watch that lab work.
And it's just cool, you know. Like I said, the e-collar, if I can hold her up till we can get in position, just, you know, talking to her and getting her there, and when we're running the dog, it works out great for me. I love it, and like I said, these guys are real tolerant of my dog breaking protocol, you know, on point dogs. There's no back with her, you know. You're not back.
Sure.
You can hold her back, and then that's her job. She thinks that's her job, and then it's a race to the retrieve, so, but it's
right. Right, there's no backing with it. It's like, why are you stopped? The bird's right here. I'm going in. Like, get out of my way.
Yep.
You should be running. What is wrong with you? Hello, there's a bird.
Are you scared of it? Why did you stop?
I'm moving in. That's exactly how a lab is in my mind, right? But like,
right.
Hello, what's wrong with you? It's my job. Get out of my way. Oh, I'm sorry. You're in my way. I will push you. You're blocking the only path. Here I come.
Yeah, that's a lab for sure.
Pretty much, just that big goofy personality that's like, I can do no wrong.
Right.
Well, let's tell everyone how to get a hold of you guys. I mean, you're Upland, Arizona. I mean, we didn't touch much on that, but let's give us a quick rundown on what Upland, Arizona is and how they can find you.
Well, right now we're on Instagram at Upland, Arizona. It's just the three of us taking pictures, sharing our experiences, sharing our thoughts. And it's just for fun. That's what it's all about. Anyways. How about you guys?
No, absolutely. A couple of years ago, Trace started us a website and said, hey, this is just going to be a dumping ground for me, you, and Josh to dump our pictures, because we don't hunt together every time. We'll hunt together probably 2-3 times a year at least, you know. But last year, I think I went out 23 times. You know, just because I like to track stuff like that, which dogs went out and where, you know, stuff like that. But
sure.
And we'll hunt together three to six times a year. But really, this is just for us. We dumped it, made a little dump station to drop our photos in. And then we all just commented on it. And then Trace got us on the Instagram, and that's way better. Now we can see like-minded people and everything. Hey, we turned.
Oh, drop him.
Uh-oh. Sure. We might lose Jimmy. This was a running joke before we started, everyone. I mean, is Jimmy there? Is Jimmy gone? Is Jimmy? Oh, Jimmy's still there.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah. just for the record, we've got one of these Shark vacuums, the automatic vacuums, and we are on number 3. This is our third attempt at it, and that's what was going on there. So, sorry about that.
Got it.
I lost it. Sorry.
Nope, you're good. You're just talking Upland, Arizona, and the website being a dumping ground because you guys don't hunt together as much as you. I mean, I get it. I mean, you're a group of friends, and you try to get out 2, 3, solid 4, 5, as much as you can, but it's hard to get together, right? It is.
Right.
Everyone's got their own jobs, their own lives, their own schedules. So you like, I get it. Like, you made the website just so like, here, let's throw all of our pictures together and let's like we're all friends, we're all pals, let's collaborate and let's like,
right,
let's chase that social media stuff, right?
Yeah, and the social media was like a second thought. We were just doing that website just for us. And then I don't know what got me thinking. I was like, you know what, let's try Instagram. See, you know, what people think. Because I'm not a social media person. I don't have Facebook. I just started the Instagram thing. But man, it's opened my eyes to a lot of stuff. That's a lot of people out there, a lot of different stuff I want to experience now as far as where to hunt, different birds. Sure. Yeah, so it's for us. At the end of the day, Upland, Arizona is for us just to have fun.
And I really like the direction we're moving, where we're doing gear reviews, and the gear reviews is just for the for us, you know, the normal guys. Hey, this is what's available for us. It opens, you know, for until he opened my eyes on a different type of vest. I was still running just the normal vest that, you know, the old vest that we get from whatever, Walmart or wherever.
Sure.
And it didn't understand the whole deal. I mean, we're running high tech, you know, and everything's kind of going better. You know, you are getting the Lewis dog boots. We're getting the Garmin Instinct watch to go with our Garmin. And that's probably the best thing I had last year, being able to look down and see the dogs instead of flip up my transmitter and when you're running multiple dogs. And then the Q5 vest and all the vests we're doing now, and we're just putting our thoughts on them. No one's paying us, no one's giving us anything for it. And it's, hey, if you're the normal guy, this is what we're paying for it, this is what we think, and it's good stuff, you know.
See, and that's awesome, and that's hard to find these days. It really is. It's hard to find non-biased paid for reviews,
right?
It really is.
I agree. And I'm shocked that people even want to hear from us. Like when you said you wanted to interview us and have us on the podcast, I was like, all right, let's do this. I mean, that's fun. I don't know why you want us, but we'll do it. And we got another podcast interview in 2 weeks, I think.
Well, there you go. Was this your first ever?
Yeah, you are first, Brad.
Oh, boom. There we go. I'm down with history. I'll play Arizona's first podcast. We'll have to bring you back on like in 3 years when you guys are like big time collaborators and be like, hey, remember me back here?
Brad, I think I'll still have problems with this phone, this communication stuff here. But hey, we'll give it a shot. 3 years might have it worked out.
Perfect. I like it. But no, it's great that you guys are like doing it on your own. Like you're buying your own gear, you're testing it out, you're being like, this is what I like, this is what I don't like. You're willing to put like buy quality gear and put it through its paces. And that brings a lot to the table. And for me, I mean, part of the reason I asked you guys like to be on the show was.
Uh-oh, now we lost Brad.
Yeah.
I wonder if we're still recording.
It says we're live. Well, Brad, I've taken over the show. I guess not.
So
maybe his phone died. Actually, I should look at this. Well, we thought it was gonna be you, Jimmy, dropping.
Yeah, it was me. Yeah, Josh, what's your favorite quail species in Arizona to hunt?
I love them all. I must say some of the coolest experiences I've had, well, geez, I've had them all on all three species. But one thing that came to my mind while we were sitting here talking.
All right.
There he is.
We continued on without you, Brad.
I appreciate it. I could hear you guys. I couldn't see you guys. I couldn't talk. I have everything through a docking station on my laptop. My wife came downstairs to turn the lights on. I'm already down here, so the lights got turned off, thus killing power to the docking station, but not the laptop. So, like, I run an external mic, external headphones, external – well, not external headphones, but external mic and camera, and all that went dead. And it's still dead. Like, you can tell it's a different camera angle now. Like, it's like, how do I get back in here as fast as possible? What do I got to do? I can't get it to work. All right, exit the studio, jump back in. I heard you guys talk about your favorite types of quail to hunt. I love it. We're not editing any of them.
Josh, continue.
Well, we were just talking about some cool experiences we have. Which one is my favorite to hunt? I love them all. I have some awesome experiences, but we talked about earlier in the show the light coming on, and I remember my first Brit, her name's Ellie, and I probably three or four different times trying to get her to pick them up because I was told they smell a little bit different than the gambles and the scaled, so it's a little bit harder for your dogs to pick up on them. And so I took her down there multiple times. She could not pick them up. And then I went down there with a buddy of mine named Dave, and that it was one of those instances where the light bulb came on. And the GPS caller rang and said she was on point. And I was like, she's probably just sitting there under a tree or whatever. And I get up over this hill, and I got Ellie from Dave. And so Dave had Ellie's mom, her name was Jenny, with us on this hunt. And Jenny and Ellie were side by side on the top of this hill, both pointing down in the bottom of this little ravine. And I to this day, I wish I would have just pulled out my phone and took a picture of it, because that meant more to me than seeing the quail, you know,
sure,
rise. But it was the coolest moment to come over that hill and see them both locked up and know that she figured it out. She figured out what to look for.
Right.
So that was really cool. And that was on our Mearns quail hunt. And then just a little quick story on a scaled quail hunt. It was in tall grass. It's probably up to my waist, so it's a little bit tough to see the dogs. But again, I was watching Ellie, and she's puts her nose up. She knows where the birds are, and I just followed behind her for at least 100 yards, but she was just slowly moving, and then she finally comes to a freeze, and there's a bunch of scaled quail hiding in this tall grass. But it's just cool to see her figure that one out as well, and to just wind them and know when to move and know when to stop and stuff. It was really cool.
Right on. So you're mostly Mearns would be probably your favorite one to hunt.
Mearns are scaled. I really think scaled are fun. The scaled quail, it's really open, usually no trees at all. And scalies, when they fly, they usually go up and they catch the wind and they're gone. So you get a brief moment of a shot coming up off the ground, but then you got to learn how to swing that gun real quick because they catch that wind and they're, you know, like a bullet.
Right. Jimmy, what's your favorite?
Yeah, probably.
I got to hear everyone's favorite. I mean, did I miss Traces though? Like, or no, I jumped in. I got back in fast enough. My 30-second delay. Really, I just ran outside for a quick smoke. I mean, that's what.
All right.
Yeah, I'd say I love the gambles quail. I mean, we could have three different answers here, but you know, obviously, but the gambles are, you know, Arizona's synonymous with the gambles quail. You know, they're all over the place they're around. I love the fact that you get, when you bust a covey up, you know, your dog will be on point. You'll get in there and you can bust you'll have that first covey rise, but then as you're clearing that area, walking through there, you get lots, you know, get singles and doubles popping off. It's not just like when you're out there on the prairie hunting a pheasant and that thing blows out and that's your one opportunity type deal. Or, you know, I just love the fact with the gambles, when you're cruising through there, you can see a whole covey of birds get up. You might see 15 birds get up and run, you know, fly over there. You watch, you mark them where you go, you work that area, and you'll start, your dog will start popping and start hitting and pointing on singles and doubles, and it just gives you I just love the gambles quail for that purpose. So the multiple, you know, chances at that covey.
Right. I'm trying to think of my favorite. Gambles are pretty close. We're right in gambles country, so we don't have to go far. So it's easy to go out there and hunt gambles. I hunt them most. But then there's Mearns. Mearns, you got to drive 2.5 hours for, right? And I've got an interesting relationship with Merns. I love to hunt them, but I hate hunting them while I'm there. Because you fall, you get your butt kicked because it's tall grass that you're walking in, and there's big rocks that you're just tripping on all the time. These birds aren't in easy walking areas.
It'd be close to like chukar hunting on smaller hills.
A smaller scale.
It's a lot like chukar hunting.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. But I love how Merns hold. I mean, they'll hold, and it's great for the dogs. They're not as frustrating, I don't think, as far as the running goes, because I haven't seen them run. I know some people have said that Merns do run on them. I've never seen it. Scalies are fun. I don't have a favorite. I love them all, man.
He says that, but I'll tell you this, Brad. I shot my first Merns with Trace the season before, and he was ecstatic. It was like a dad with his kid at Christmas, man. When I got my first Merns, he was so proud of me. And, you know, good job, you know. And it was awesome, man. So he might have that love-hate relationship, but I'll tell you what, he makes it. He gets down there, and you can see the passion and the excitement. It's kind of like that duck hunter that loves calling in the ducks and lets you do all the shooting.
Sure.
He kind of like has that same feel when you're down there with him. But, yeah, it was good. I really appreciate that, Trace. Thanks for taking me down there.
I think I do get more excited when someone gets their first Merns than I do for anything else. Because not everyone gets to hunt Merns. I mean, people come from all over the world to come to Arizona or New Mexico to hunt these birds. So when you put someone on them and they get it, it's exciting. Josh put me on my first Merns. So, I mean, we share it. We share the experience. We share the excitement, man.
That's awesome. That's awesome, though. I mean, like, you guys are sharing, with each other, like, how to hunt these birds, right? Like, Josh got it on Merns. Like, you're in, like, the other country. I mean, it's like, that's really great. Like, you guys can work together and, like, really focus on. Because if you're in Merns country and that's what you hunt, hey, I know where they're kind of. I have an idea where we should go, right? Or if you're in scaled country, or if you're in, I don't remember the other one already.
Gambles.
Like, it's awesome that you guys kind of work together that way and just like, hey, let's go hunt here.
Yeah, absolutely. But we don't tell anybody else, Brad.
No, that's all right. I wouldn't either. That's a really good spot, okay, man.
You know, the blindfold will be clean. We'll show you. Come on down here. We'll get some birds.
And I think we all have our own in our own stash pocket, too.
Oh yeah, you can't give away all your good spots.
We try.
Yeah,
that's like when you start like blurring out the background or hiding the background in photos on your own website, you know you got something good.
Yeah.
Hey, why can't I really tell where this is? Don't worry about it.
We try and pick and choose which pictures we put up.
Trace will tell me, hey, that's too much of that one mountain range. Don't put that one up there.
You gotta be careful. You gotta be careful on social media, though. You really do on how much how much information is actually shown in the pictures you post.
Right.
Because you can ruin a good spot completely unintentionally by blasting it out there.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. Well, gentlemen. We're right about an hour and a half, so I think we're going to wrap this one up. It's been a great episode. You can reach you at Upland Arizona on Instagram. Are you sharing your website, or is that still a private deal?
It's not quite up and ready the way you want it to be, but I will share it on Instagram once we get it going.
Perfect. Any personal pages you guys want to shout out? Any sponsors that Upland Arizona has, or anything you want to recognize that people that you've helped out, like moved you along in this path?
For me, well, Dan Priest has helped me a lot. He's the founder of Q5. Arlette and Steve over at K9 Brittany's, they breed some amazing dogs, and they help me with training all the time. And they're great people. So I want to thank them. They have helped me a lot. And these two guys helped me more than I would ever imagined. So,
no, absolutely. Yeah. We're up to, I think we're just, if anybody has a product that they believe in, shoot us a shot, you know, let us reach out to us on Instagram, and we'd love to try some good stuff. We want the best stuff that we can run for our dogs, with our dogs in the field. Let us know what you got to offer, and we'd love to check it out. And
somebody please come up with an upland pant that can handle this desert needles.
That's the ask, everyone. That's the ask when I make this Facebook episode, like not Facebook episode, when I make the like thumbnail for this, it's gonna be like, we need an upland pant that can handle thorns.
Yeah.
or cattail. Cactus, that's what it's gonna be. Cactus. We need a cactus proof pants. That's what we're looking for. A cactus proof pant. That's how we're gonna end it.
Lightweight and breathable and
right.
It's not gonna happen.
Waterproof as well for the dew in the morning, right? So you need waterproof, yep. Breathable, lightweight. Yet enough to like stop a razor blade.
Yeah.
Right.
God, I want this pant to be able to climb over barbed wire and razor wire fences when I'm done. Yet it's still got to breathe when it's hot out.
Yeah. Yeah. They have to kill a unicorn for that.
We're gonna get NASA in on this.
Yep.
Well, thanks for having us, Brad. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on. Stick around for a minute on the back studio here, and then. For everyone else, I appreciate you tuning in, and until next time.
Thanks for tuning in to another killer episode on Paddle and Fin. Don't forget to go check out our website at paddlenfin.com. Don't forget to check out the YouTube channel at Paddle and Fin. If you got a question, comment, want to hear from a future guest on a future episode, feel free to email us at paddlenfin@gmail.com. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Paddle and Fin on Facebook and Instagram. Shout out to our show supporters, Angler. The Angler button and app just makes for a better time on the water. And creates a virtual logbook for every fishing outing out on the water. Shout out to Rocktown Adventures, located in Northern Illinois, for all your kayaking, camping, and hiking needs. Shout out to Jigmasters Jigs. When in doubt, get the jig out. Go to jigmasters.com.